Rupert Gould is Britain's newest directing star. He's already been a building-based artistic director in Northampton and is now running Headlong, the company once known as the Oxford Stage Company. Productions which have sent the critics scrabbling for superlatives include Paradise Lost at Northampton, A Daring Faustus, a version of which is still touring, into which he wove a narrative about the young Brit artists, the Chapman Brothers, and An Arctic Tempest for the RSC, starring Patrick Stewart. His production of Carol Phillips' version of Simon Sharma's account of the abolition of the slave trade, Rough Crossings, has just finished a run at the Lyric Hammersmith and is also still touring. And his Macbeth, first seen at Chichester, has won 5-star reviews at the Gielgud, where it will play until December the 1st. I'm Heather Neal, and Rupert Gould has found time in the middle of all this to talk to me for Theatre Voice at his home in North London. Patrick Stewart, familiar to many people, of course, from the X-Men and Star Trek and so on, has come back to Shakespeare in the last few years, and he's following his Prospero, which he did for you, with Macbeth. I wondered if the Stalinist style of the production that you've chosen came about partly because Patrick Stewart is rather more mature than Macbeths we are used to. Did the two come together? Did you feel you had to provide reasons for this soldier being a bit older than usual?
Yeah, I think that was exactly it, actually. I'm trying to think. It's quite difficult to trace back exactly where that side of it did come. I think I was interested in... clearly, if Macbeth is... Well, Patrick's in his 60s, and it felt right that Banquo and probably Macduff were of the same generation, and possibly Duncan as well. And so there was a sort of group of generals who, you know, in the later part of their life... And I was sort of interested in that kind of, actually, initially it was in that sort of Brezhnev period, 80s, where you had sort of loads of generals who sort of seemed, one would drop off and another would take over, and there was a sense of sort of stasis and monumentalism about the regime, and that into the regime change that Malcolm sort of brings about would feel like, and I was actually thinking, I hadn't really thought about it this way, but actually, I was... 16 in 1988, and although that period of revolution kind of felt very exciting and kind of romantic to me at the time, and maybe I was subconsciously looking at that, but I was also interested, I think, actually, in the and what I try and do with Shakespeare is think about why elements of other performances or even production histories that I've seen haven't worked, and I was interested in how...
Plenty of those with Macbeth.
Yes, yeah. I mean, as I said on the first ever rehearsals, I said I think there have been 3 successful ones since the war, so we're up against it. But I wanted to try and look at a way of performing it that was less histrionic and kind of breathy and sort of sensationalist in a way, and was more about either a sort of Pinteresque kind of precision with the language, or more particularly, I suppose, with a world where... there's daggers in men's smiles, as I think Donald Bain says, that people use doublespeak, and so I looked a lot at sort of I suppose noir and Le Carré and people like that, and so that began to push it back a bit into sort of the classic Cold War era, and then once we'd started doing that, then the Stalin. I mean, Patrick brought a lot of the Stalin stuff, actually. I mean, I was always interested in Stalin, but of course, as we researched it, there were just so many fantastic theatrical things that have made it into the production from Stalin's own life that crept in. But I never set out to conceive it as a Soviet production at all. I mean, in fact, I went to the designer and said, actually, I have 2 completely independent productions that I'm interested in. One is this Cold War Soviet production, and the other is... I'm really interested in setting the whole thing in a kitchen. And I think that had come from The Cook, the Thief, the Wife and His Lover.
The Peter Greenaway film,
yeah, that had influenced me a lot in my thinking about it. But also...
This is Anthony Ward, the designer.
Yeah.
And so he was on board at an early stage then, was he?
Yes, he was. I mean, that came about sort of slightly accidentally. We'd never worked before together, but I think I'd... I have done quite a bit of Shakespeare now, and lessons learned sometimes the hard way. you know, in certain theatres, and actually ironically Minerva probably would be one of these, the rapid scene movement of Shakespeare is really wonderful, and certain plays that works really beautifully, but I was interested in trying to create two long acts at the beginning of the play, the second one in Glam's Castle, and the first one in a, as we conceived it, in a sort of field hospital.
So perhaps we should give some idea about what this strange room is like. It's a rather bleak tiled room with a clanking old-fashioned lift out of which people pour at intervals, and to begin with, it's a sort of field hospital.
Well, I was interested.
And then a kitchen.
Yes, those sort of old 19th century or sort of early 20th century. You know, we talked about Gosford Park a bit. The kind of the kitchen in that. They were not saying that kitchens as a place where that are the sort of the hum and focal point of a large house or castle. You know, where people congregate or welcome, but
not usually the upper classes though.
No, but you often go down and check the. Maybe check the preparations and also this was a slightly kind of reading between the lines, but one of the things that interested Patrick and I was that Duncan appears never to have been to Glam's before. He certainly, when he arrives, he talks about it as though, well, this is a nice place, and he was saying, well, that's kind of interesting, isn't it, that the king, if Macbeth was a senior thane, then you'd think he'd be around a lot, and certainly he seems to know. A lot of them seem to know each other quite well. He knows Banquo seemingly much better than he knows Macbeth. And we were sort of interested that maybe Macbeth, until he'd met Lady Macbeth, had been a kind of slightly provincial, not particularly classy, kind of rural boy who had kind of, in Glam's, was a bit of an out-of-the-way place. And so that maybe they weren't that, well off, and that the arrival certainly... Macbeth says to Banquo, he says, I was slightly embarrassed that the king's turned up, we weren't really prepared. Yeah. And Banquo says, oh no, don't worry. And there is this feeling of there's maybe a slightly bored sort of...
make-do about it.
Exactly, yeah. And again, that sort of resonated strangely with the Starling thing as well, at the sort of the provincial boy who then gets power and of course in our production behaves fairly boorishly. I don't want to take a reactionary position about being to the manor born, but I mean that was sort of interesting. And the room, yeah, so the room came part was Gosford Park. I was interested in the Greenaway kitchen. I was interested in again, as always, horror films. The kitchen in The Shining was a big influence.
Plenty of blood.
Yes, exactly.
you've mentioned all sorts of things there. Your interest in films is obviously very important. And you actually use film in the background of the production as well, don't you?
Yeah.
Marching soldiers. But you said something quite interesting the other day. I heard you say that you were also interested in theatrical effects in film, which is a bit more difficult to pull off, isn't it? And yet you've also said you don't particularly want to direct film, not at the moment anyway. So what was this idea about theatrical effects in film?
And the person I think is interesting is Lars von Trier, who's he made that extraordinary musical out of a Death Row story in Dance in the Dark, and then Dogville is sort of, the rooms are only kind of indicated by chalk lines on the floor, and I think that interests me in terms of theatre effects in film, and then film in theatre. I mean, I suppose in Macbeth the obvious examples are the kind of rewind we do by playing the banquet twice.
Yes, you have the interval there, don't you? While the banquet's happening, and then we start with it again.
Yes, I mean, that came about just because I mean, some directors are brave, and I wish I was more like this about just saying they read the script and do their production, but I tend to pore over previous productions, with great, intensity. And it felt very much that the orthodoxy was in the bank, in the ghost scene, was either you saw the ghost or you didn't see the ghost. Yeah. I'd actually played Banquo at the university, so I knew the different options there. And of course, if you don't see the ghost, then it becomes very interior, and it becomes about Macbeth's mind. But equally, if you don't see the ghost, it's not very scary, it feels. And I was trying to think, is there some way we could do both? So we sort of do a version of playing the scene twice in different ways. I mean, it's not quite as clunky as that.
Works. It really does. You've said something already about the relationship between Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, and of course the huge age difference. He's old enough to be her father in this production. Must have been something you talked about in rehearsals, I should imagine, because quite often they are a very close couple to begin with, and it's the future of both of them that they're interested in. In this case, it's a bit different, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it was. And Patrick always wanted to have a big age gap, partly because he knew he was a bit old, maybe a convention if playing the role. You know, he was interested in. I mean, I think it is interesting to look at the play as. Because the play works wonderfully if Macbeth is 20 or 40 or 80 in a way, but totally differently. And there's something about the ambition of a man at the end of his life. You know, he's sort of towed the line and suddenly, you know, it goes the wrong way. And, you know, I think our society is very interested in. I mean, it was really hard not to talk about Paul McCartney and his wife when we were rehearsing because, you know, we the trope of an older man kind of corrupted by some harridan, you know, something that we plug into. I don't know why. I suppose maybe women plug into it because of a fear of the threat of the young woman, and men plug into it for a fear of emasculation. And I think that was a big thing about it was, you know, I think the play is about masculinity and different kinds of masculinity and different kinds of sort of...
Yes, there's a lot in what is a man.
What is a man?
And has another resonance, of course, when it's someone who's at the end of his career.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she says, you know, be a man, and you aren't thou a man. Wonderful. My favourite line in the play, I think, is... My favourite exchange in the play was after Macduff hears the news, his children and wife have been killed, and Malcolm says, dispute it like a man. And he says, I will do so, but I must also feel it like a man. And it's the first time that sort of sensibility is acknowledged as manly rather than feminine or weak in some way. Yeah, we did talk about that. And I think, I mean, actually, when we started, Patrick and I conceiving the project, you know, I don't think it was very much in the public knowledge that Patrick had a girlfriend who was 45 years younger than him or something, 40 years younger than him. And, you know, I suppose he was interested in the way people were treating him with that as well. I mean, it's certainly not a new reading, you know, because I think, you know, Richard Eyre did it, didn't he, with Alan Howard and Anastasia Hiller, you know, that was about 20 years ago or something. Mm. So, and it's been done a lot. I think what it also did was, what I used to say to Kate a lot was...
This is Kate Fleetwood, who's playing Lady Macbeth and happens to be Mrs. Gould as well.
Yes, I know. a circuitous route to her being cast for that as well. But,
yes, I don't think anyone thinks she's in it because she's the director's wife. Exactly.
Well, no, we saw lots of other people, and then the cast director kept saying, well, why are we not seeing Kate? And I said, we can't do that. anyway, when we were rehearsing it, I said, and maybe it was the liberty and an actor of... independent from me might not have been able to take this note, but actors always are interested and drawn to the idea of complexity and multifacetedness and three-dimensionality or whatever that might mean in characterization, and yet on screen and on stage, of course, as well, often incredibly vivid two-dimensional characters, you know, just as arresting. And you know, if you look at like a character like the MC in Cabaret, you know, you don't, it's one of the great characters in world drama, but you don't think, oh, what's his backstory, or kind of, you know, what I said to Katie was that actually I think Lady Macbeth's function partly in the play, and all characters are functions of a narrative, is to be an incredibly strong colour, ambition, sexuality, psychosis. You know, she must be a psychotic.
The beginning. She doesn't really go mad, does she? She already has
seeds of it. I think she's destroyed by her madness. I mean, I know Judy Dench did it very differently, but I was interested in that she was the, you know, not that I know anything about this era, but that she was the Liam Brady to his Myra Hindley, that she was a genuine psycho. That's my phone ringing. And that Macbeth was in her grip, but... Macbeth is tortured by his sanity, you know, not his insanity, I think. Mm-hmm. And the age gap sort of helped that in a way. Mm. Again, in the way that people look at, you know, I suppose, poor Heather McCartney, and they see her very two-dimensionally, don't they? You know, Lady Muck, you know, that's what she is. Mm. But that's part of her potency.
Well, there's a very interesting essay by Jonathan Bate in the in the programme about the point at which this play was written, which was quite soon after the Gunpowder Plot, when King James, who was very interested in witchcraft and an intellectual interested in many things, including the Divine Right of Kings, had only been on the throne for about 3 years. And Jonathan Bate seems to be bringing this play into line with others of Shakespeare's plays, where he's really writing about current matters, but in metaphorical terms. Was that part of your idea as well? I mean, are you commenting on now? You seem to be, as well as doing the play, as it were. I mean, did you bring Jonathan Bate on board with this kind of idea because it was partly your idea, was it? How did that come?
I don't know what happened with Jonathan. I've always liked Jonathan's writings. I've never actually met Jonathan, but I'd done a play at Stratford a couple of years ago called Speaking Like Magpies, which had been a new play by Frank McGuinness about the Gunpowder Plot. So I'd done a lot of research into the world of it. And you know, that play was very much, I suppose, or actually maybe not as it might have been, but I think 5.11 at the Chichester was even more so, was looking at the parallels between, you know, when you have a major terrorist act in the Jacobean case that attempted blowing up Parliament, for us I guess it's 9/11, it legitimises a kind of state tyranny, and that Cecil and his spy ring and the kind of illegal persecution of the Catholic minority in Britain is comparable in some ways to the Guantanamo culture that we're in, and so of course Macbeth does a similar thing, but I hope that the parallels would speak for themselves. I mean, I think the one that we did talk a lot about was Saddam Hussein, actually, and the in Act 5 of Macbeth, the sort of watching Saddam kind of furious in those trials, and also achieve a strange kind of charisma and dignity, you know, in that open neck shirt, and yet also his the humiliation of his capture, and then but above all of his death, you know, and Macbeth beheaded, his head's put on a spike, you know, the brutalism and the sort of nihilism of that we talked a lot about. And we, of course, we have an interrogation scene, but sadly, I suspect those things are fairly timeless rather than specific to now. I mean, a film.
Yes, you seem to have avoided making parallels that are too tight, too obvious, because that leads you to problems, doesn't it? Sort of, you have influences rather than.
I think it's very important that, I mean, this thing of these two productions, the sort of Politico-Cold War Stalinite kind of production, but then also this abstract Greenaway Dead Butcher kitchen kind of world coming together, I really learned this on The Tempest, actually, and other Shakespeare's I did at Northampton, that if you just try and straitjacket into, oh, we're going to set it in whatever, you know, 1943 Great Britain, as I did with an Othello, of course there are parallels, but the works are by nature poetic, and you must allow, so although people talk about our Tempest as being like an Arctic Tempest, and that was a big factor, it was also Arctic trying to mix with Beckett, and it's the abstract that's really important that stops the sort of rather prosaic straight political parallel reading, and so it's really important that we have these sort of Kubrick-like qualities in Macbeth rather than just, you know, a kind of straight old Macbeth the Timeless play about kind of power and tyranny, I think.
If I remember rightly, I think you draw back somewhat in the Macduff scene. It's too much for us to watch, isn't that right?
The killing of
the Macduff's family.
Yes, I mean, did you see it in Chichester or in London?
In London.
Yeah, it's funny. We have a little. The killers arrive, and then there's a sort of blackout. And then there was a much debated and much teched moment. You see a glimpse of something horrific. and I was always thought, oh, it's a bit vulgar, that it's a bit too much of a slasher kind of effect. And I think in Chichester it lasted for, it was something like 2.4 seconds. And in London it lasts for 1.6 seconds. And it seemed to make all the difference that you just blink and you think you've seen something, you see something and it goes. Whereas if you stay too long, it just feels like clumsy.
Voyeurism.
I mean, actually, the Shakespeare is fairly voyeuristic with all the murder of the boy, and we did cut some lines there.
Yes.
Yes, again, it's that sort of, Jesus, who am I to better Shakespeare, especially mature Shakespeare like this, which is brilliant. But you know, the success of any dramatist is when they come into a scene and when they leave a scene, and we just tried leaving the scene a fraction earlier to make the suggestion more awful.
Well, dealing with the weird sisters is always a problem, isn't it?
Yeah,
and they've been bag ladies and goodness knows what over the years. Yours are integrated very much into the world of Macbeth. How did that come about?
It was
because they're nurses to begin with, weren't they? And then servants.
It was, again, I think I read an interview with Wes Craven of Nightmare on Elm Street fame. We're talking about Nightmare on Elm Street and saying that, you know, most good myths of terror prey on when you feel most secure. And that Nightmare on Elm Street hinged on, you know, the horrific stuff only happened when you were tucked up in your bed. And psycho, I suppose, works. You know, you're sort of in a shower, in the bath, or in a shower. You sort of would, you don't expect to be attacked there. You know, maybe in a dark wood you do. So I was sort of thinking, well, you know, what are those environments where one feels unsettled? I saw a brilliant Cracker or something, or something on telly as well, where the suspect was interviewing the detective, but the suspect was an ophthalmic optician. And as you can see, I wear glasses. You know that feeling when you sit and they have their, you put your chin on a rest and they're looking right into your eye. And it was an incredibly brilliantly written scene because you feel terribly vulnerable. Someone's right in your eyeball. And yet, and I was thinking, so what if we want the witches to be scary? And I think that's really important that they are scary, and I'm sure they were terrifying to the Jacobean audience. You know, how can we make them scary? And so I just sort of wrote down a list of places that you feel unsettled yet should feel safe, like in a dentist's chair or in our world, in hospital, you know, which, of course...
But there are also people you're relying on there. They're exactly the people who shouldn't be.
Exactly. It came out of, I think, you know, the... when I was doing The Tempest, I was, for some reason, and you know, not sort of rationally, but I got incredibly nervous on the first preview, not the press night. I think it was just the size of the audience and main house debut and everything. And I got... I terrible kind of pain in my stomach, my chest, and so the show went on, but then rather than it going, it got worse the next day. Unless it was a Friday night, and Saturday felt even worse. And I said to Kate, oh gosh, I feel really ill, I think I don't know what's wrong with me, I've got cancer or something. So on Sunday I rang the emergency doctor and went up the road to the Whittington, and I was let down. It was completely empty, the Whittington, except for some people who were clearly way on the way out, you know, on the oncology ward, and fairly grim. Very sunny day there. I went down into the basement, and there was this very beautiful kind of raven-haired Chinese, Anglo-Chinese doctor in a white nurse's kind of doctor's outfit, and there was no one in the waiting room. She came out, and I went in, and I said, look, I think I'm dying. I've got this terrible heart problem, I think. And there was something about the solitude of it, and, you know, thinking as she was listening to my chest or whatever they do, this can go one of two ways. Either she's going to say, yes, there is something really wrong here, or as inevitably she did say, no, you're just a bit stressed. But in that moment, I felt, you know, I wanted to abandon myself to the medical side, but also I was terrified of the mortal element. Yeah. And I think she, unbeknownst, has made it into the play or onto the West End.
Well, that's fascinating. I hope she's seen it. the whole idea of evil, of course, runs through Macbeth more than it does any other play probably that I've ever come across. Well, and I mean, is that something that you're interested in? Because modern directors tend to say, well, there's no such thing as evil. We've got to find the psychological reasons for Macbeth behaving like this. It could be any of us. If just something had happened to us, we could have been tempted, and it's all just normal human behaviour. But I get the feeling in your production that there really is an evil around.
Yeah, I think, again... I wonder whether it's conscious that way, whether it's just trying to be unsettling. I mean, it's a terrible hippie-ish thing to say, but I'm interested in sort of spirituality in some sense, and that, not that I have any specific faith, but it's interesting that, I suppose, of my the shows that I suppose I feel I'm proudest of, or I have the strongest connection with, that Paradise Lost and Faustus.
Yes.
And Macbeth all deal very directly with hell.
Yes.
And
yes, I noticed that.
and there is, you know, the undead or the afterlife is very much addressed in Tempest as well, and in a different way. And so I seem to have had a lot of discussions about what hell is anyway. And, you know, from a cameo position right through to an Old Testament position. And I think I am interested in three plays, actually. I haven't really thought about it before, actually. Those three plays all are interested in the irrevocable act, you know, signing your soul to the devil, biting an apple, killing a king, are all, you know, that act from which you can never go back from. And I think in some senses we can all relate to that, but the pitying finality of that, or the tragic finality of that, I'm quite interested in. And then they're also interested in despair, and at what point when you give up hope, and I don't know why it's a gloomy thing. My life isn't like that at all, but fate I'm more interested in than evil. I think I don't know. It's probably raking around and stuff that I probably haven't really thought through properly.
The end of the play, is this the textbook order returning, or is it just another point from which another kind of chaos can come?
Yes, that is interesting. I think it is an old-fashioned catharsis, I hope. Not order returning, but certainly malignancy released. You know, and I think, why was I, again, I suppose it's about that, the same question as the evil question, actually. It's sort of, I'm interested in the spiritual gestation of the piece rather than just its political sensibility. And I think, again, it does come back to the evil thing, actually. And to answer more directly about the evil, I think one of the hardest things in Macbeth is that the witches are malicious. You can't read them any other way. The neutral mask, you know, where Macbeth just receives a mirror and then becomes undone, works on some lines. I mean, certainly they say to him, you'll be king, but they don't say kill the king. But then a lot of their material, it probably is the Middleton stuff rather than the Shakespeare, is, you know, I'm going to drain him dry as hay, you know, we're going to destroy him. And so I don't think you can approach Macbeth without trying to have some forces of destruction and them having spending themselves or working themselves out in a kind of Furies way. I think it's an old-fashioned tragic reading the play. I said I'm interested in the play as a tragedy. I'm not interested in it as a sort of political document. And I know that is.
But it can only work if he has the fault they can play on. I mean, Banquo doesn't.
Yes, in the Brandian sense. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Although the suggestion is Banquo might go that way. I mean, he does say just in that little soliloquy, "Why can't I become king as well?" And then too late, he's done. Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny. At university, we had to do a compulsory paper on tragedy, and I remember things. Oh, it's such an old-fashioned thing to do, tragedy. I mean, I don't mind studying things, but what is a tragedy? But I think, you know, you do feel tragedy, and you only. I think dramatic tragedy, you only feel in the theatre. You know, sometimes you just get that kind of strange, you know, beyond moving, when it's not moving but it's just awesome and shocking. And some production, we probably don't even achieve it every night on Macbeth, but when we do, you can really feel it, and it's a really special thing. I think it's a sort of,
is that something particular to theatre that you don't get in cinema?
I think it is. It's like the sound barrier in a funny way. You know, there's a bang when you go through it, and I think tragedy, you know, you sort of,
and it's the fact that it's being done for you that night, and it will never be the same again.
Yes, and it's often when the main protagonists achieve something or find something transcendent on the night that, you know, even by seeming to do the same thing the night before, doesn't quite happen. And it requires the audience as well. Actually, I mean, it's interesting at the moment, you know, as you can probably hear in my voice, I'm just at the end of a cold, and you know, it's that time of year when there are a lot of colds. And of course, if you have a lot of cough, we're totally sold out, so there's a lot of people in the theatre and they all cough a lot, then it could be enough to slightly break it. Or a phone going off.
Before we finish, perhaps we should return to Rough Crossings just briefly. How does this fit into your work so far? I mean, obviously you wanted to do it because of the bicentenary of the abolition of the slave trade, but do you see any connection between other work you've done and this?
Well, the big connection is Simon Sharma. You know, I'm interested in you know, working with people who aren't normally associated with theatre, so the Chapman Brothers, for example. I've always loved the way Simon's sort of intellect works in his books, and that he's a kind of magpie, and he's able to construct great stories out of quite diverse historical materials. Mm-hmm. And Rough Crossings, in some ways, is a slightly more conventional book in that it follows a sort of a straightforward secret history. It's not a kind of essay. But his intellect, I think, really drew me in and felt headlong, or kind of what we wanted to do with headlong. But also, you know, we are a national touring company. We're funded to be a major national touring company. It's really important that we address issues that are of national importance, and, of course, diversity and the history and what the legacy of the slave trade is really central to that. And you know, all the big national level, everyone should be doing something to look at that. You know, and it's epic storytelling, I suppose, as well. It's a big epic story, and that, you know, I suppose is linked to Paradise Lost and Angels in America and some of the other big stuff that we've done.
Well, the final question I have to ask you: are you going to put yourself in line for the National Theatre one of these days? I know everybody wants to ask you that.
It would absolutely, genuinely, it would terrify me. But also, it just seems a million miles away. I think I said to somebody else that I sat in Nick Hartnett's office a few weeks ago, and we had a meeting about something, and I thought, God, the responsibility, not only these three big theatres and trying to find work to fill in them, but also, you know, looking out across the river and thinking, how do you know what the nation needs to... What's the nation doing? How do you respond to it dramatically?
And, of course, you want to direct yourself still as well and have time to do it.
Yeah, and I like... You know, I do like writing as well. I think, you know, my ultimate aspiration would be to try and keep developing as a director and a writer. And, I mean, I would never even begin to bracket myself in their league at all. But for me, Robert LaPage and Simon McBurney are so far above any other global practitioners, and because they are genuine theatre makers in a new way, and that's the sort of stuff I'd really love to do. And you know, Nick Hartnett's doing a great job anyway, so he's like, I'd happily come and direct for him, but I don't think I'd want to run the building.
Well, thank you very much, Rupert Gould.
Thank you.